host Spencer. I am joined by both of my co-hosts this week, John Stern.
Hey, everyone.
And American, is it captain or champion? I actually don't know. Is that Benfield?
Well, we didn't win, so we were not the champions, but...
But that's the title they give you, right? Like, they give you a medal before you, like, when you show up, right?
They did give me a medal. I was considered the captain of the U.S. squad.
So, just so we have an accurate count, how many medals do you have?
For Magic? I think that
for national champion. You have one?
That's not how that works. So the national champion is the person that won nationals.
Okay.
Yeah, this is my first, my first World Magic Cup was this past one, and okay. My first real medal.
Congratulations, ever. You have the same number of World Magic Cups, John. I hope you're proud.
No, that's not, well, I mean, I have two worlds. Like, I played on the team twice. I was only the captain one time, but the first time was not World Magic Cup. It was back in, played with Jeff Cunningham and Louis Boileau.
I would
back in 2002.
I wouldn't typically instigate this, but if you want to hold up your world championship trophy, Seth, you're more than welcome to at this point.
which one it is? I mean,
it'll take too long to figure out. But you know what doesn't take too long to figure out is how amazing our sponsor is at Oasis Games. You can check them out at mtgoasis.com. You can get 15% off of your first order using the code CCMTG at checkout. You can get 4% off of every order using the code Would That Be Good. And then you can also check out our other sponsor, Dink Gaming. And my co-hosts don't know I'm about to do this, but like, if you submit an order at Dink Gaming this week, shoot me a message. Let me know that you did that, and we will enter you into a contest. So if you go on to go get a playmat with Seth's face on it, with John's face on it, let me know. You know, but if you submit an order this week, shoot me a message. I want to know. And use the code CCMTG10 at checkout to get 10% off your order. And they give us a little bit of kickback. So thank you so much to both of our sponsors. Go ahead.
And yeah, going off of that, I'm gonna be doing my own personal giveaway. I haven't actually decided what I'm going to be giving away yet, but if you use Twitter, and I'll have the post running, and then probably next week or the following week, but probably next week I will be actually announcing the winners of that contest. So it'll probably be some cards, maybe something from a pro tour or something like that. So not going to give away the exact details yet, but it's gonna be my own personal stuff.
Oh, what about a T-shirt with all six pro tours listed on it? I didn't buy one, unfortunately.
Yeah, John's making a little bit of a joke there about six pro tours. Of course,
there's eight now. To be fair, I feel like people lost the fact that there's eight. We're gonna get into that in a moment. But before we do, if you want to enter Seth's contest, don't forget that patrons of $3 or more. So if you go to patreon.com/CCMTG, that's like, I think it's 75 cents per episode at $3 or more per month, gets entered into every contest at constructivecriticism.com. So patreon.com/CCMTG, $3 or more per month, that can be entered to win whatever Seth's going to give away. We're going to find out soon. So, speaking of the network, don't forget to check out the rest of the network at constructivecriticism.com, whether it's the stuff that I do every week on the deck techs with Snapkeeper Decade, the Trophy Mage is something that we're going to be doubling down on next year. We also have a new way to record Constructed Clash, which is a video series between myself and the host of Even Odds Pod, Mason Clark. So there's tons of stuff going on. Check it out. Go to constructivecriticism.com and check out everything going on there. As we already mentioned, you can support the show directly at patreon.com/CCMTG. Become a patron of the show. There's tons of different tiers. But to be honest with everybody, if you just donate $1 per month, if every listener of the show donated $1 per month, we would literally all – this is funny because these two are already professional Magic players, but I would also be able to quit my job. And we would just do Magic content. I would be able to do Magic content full-time with these two. So patreon.com/CCMTG. just $1 per month, if everybody listening did that, it would fully fund this podcast for in perpetuity. So check that out, patreon.com/ccmtg. So before we get into our new segment that will be coming up in a second, let's talk about hashtag always improving. Hashtag always improving is the point of this podcast. We believe if you're not getting better, you're getting worse. We will be doing what we can all the time to be improving ourselves, and we will be covering the things that we're doing to improve each week. And this week I thought I would go first. As I canceled my ManaTraders account, and I have dived full on in into MTG Arena. I have two accounts now. I have an account for the podcast for people to use, where they can have all the cards they want if they want to record a video, if they want to do anything that they want across the network. And then I have my free to play account for myself. And I've learned one thing, Seth.
Yeah.
I've learned one thing. Because I've been playing a lot of ranked, and that is that people are really, really bad against playing against Wild Growth Walker decks right now, which seems crazy. It seems crazy how good Wild Growth Walker is, considering it is a staple of the format, John. But my highest win percentage goes number one, green-black, number two, blue-white control, and then number three, green-white mid-range, which is the deck that we have posted for our patrons. And then I think number four is the deck we'll be talking about this week. But I'm shocked that people don't realize that Wild Growth Walker is a card at this point.
Well, here's the thing, and there's been some recent discussions on this, but if you're playing a best of one match rather than a best of three, then a card like a Wild Growth Walker, like, players are first of all going to gravitate more towards aggressive decks, and a card like Wild Growth Walker is really good in game one against a lot of strategies, so that could be part of the reason why you're seeing that as well.
Yeah, I think I'm like my main deck might be three or four cards off from the list that you the green black list that you played, Seth, but the number of times where Wild Growth Walker has just been insane in multiple matchups is, I mean, it's not bad in any matchup, due to the way that we built this deck, and I don't know, people don't kill it. Like, I've had people like lightning strike my planeswalkers with cards that I know they're in their hands because we're playing Arena. I'm like, you could have lightning strike that Wild Growth Walker, and you're gonna die now instead.
Yeah, it's quite a strong card, especially in Golgari, because oftentimes even if my opponent does kill it, you'll have the option later if you need to gain some life to get it back from your graveyard, to replay it, and to do some crazy stuff with it.
Yeah, late game Find Finality to get back Jade Light Ranger and it is like often game over against a lot of decks.
Yep. Especially when players are just like desperately trying to like Banefire you out late game, and then you're like, nope, I'll gain six more life. And yeah, it's like, all right.
John, what about you? I know that you know, after a ninth place finish, you might not have wanted to play Magic this week, but what have you done this week to improve Magic the Gathering?
I haven't played that much. I played a little bit more with Arclight Phoenix just because I was enjoying it. I also put together a sideboard guide, which I posted for the Patreons on the Facebook group.
Yeah, if you are a patron of $12 or more per month, you have access to a 40 deck sideboard guide from John. That's 40 decks, John. You should be touting this so much more. 40 decks.
I mean, John and I looked at the sideboard guide, and John, no, like, if you were thinking about playing blue red Arclight Phoenix, you need to look at John's, like, it's just like, he knows the deck.
It's everything. He's underselling really it right now.
39 decks because right, I made no changes against Martyr Proc. I just left it as is. I couldn't think of any card I wanted to change.
That's still 40 decks. That's insane, John. Like I, and you did this after the podcast last week. So in the last week since the podcast, like, you have really thought. I mean, and people have been commenting about your build and the changes that you and I suggested last week. On Twitter, on Facebook, like, John, is this deck for real? And is your sideboard guide going to help people learn this deck?
Well, here's what I would say. Well, first of all, the sideboard guide was built mostly after the GP. I had a sideboard guide for like 12 decks at the GP, but one of the things I want to be disciplined in doing, you learn a lot when you play a deck in a GP and go and do well. And there are things I didn't like about the deck. I actually don't like Bedlam Reveler very much. I don't think I'd play it in, you know, next week in tournament. But I wanted to take what I learned in the GP. I was thinking about a lot of different matchups that I played in that I might've played and put that in a file so that, you know, if I don't touch Modern for 3 months, I come back and I'm like, you know, maybe I play Tron or I play Affinity and I'm like, I want to play Arclight again. And I have to relearn all that stuff I figured out. And I was like, I want something I can refer to as a starting point. And what I thought was, even if people play a Crackling Drake version or, you know, some other deck, seeing how I boarded or seeing how I would board with this version is a good starting point. And it shows you like, oh, how many times am I boarding up Fiery Temper? Maybe that's a card I can cut. And what cards do you never want to cut? And what cards do you bring in a lot? And so even if you play a different version, I think it's a good starting point. And that's, so I guess that would be my always improving, is to like be disciplined after tournament to consolidate what you learned, so that you can pick it up again fresh later.
I think before that we go to Seth, I can honestly say, as somebody who consumes a ton of Magic content, that your sideboard guide on Blue Red Phoenix, which you have access to on the Patreon at $12 more per month in that Facebook group, is the most extensive piece of Magic content I have ever seen.
I don't think people realize how difficult making a sideboard guide is for Modern. I mean, there's so many decks, and it's just like...
I agree with Seth. Yeah, keep going, Seth.
Yeah, I mean, and specifically about this Blue-Red Phoenix deck, I think there's a decent chance that it's like it went from being an unknown deck, it's possibly just the best deck. Like,
I think it's tier one. I think it's tier one. I mean, I think Spirits is tier one. There's a few other decks that are really good, but I think that this is a player going forward.
Yeah, can we talk about this for like, let's try and limit this to a couple minutes, John, but like, if I were to find tier one of Modern, I would say Tron, Spirits, Blue Red Phoenix. I think Dredge has fallen off, so I wouldn't include Dredge in that. KCI. And that might be it. Maybe blue white or Jeskai.
You know, people are not playing blue white, and I'm always scared because all the decks I want to play have a tough blue white matchup.
Yeah. You guys forgot about the blue black mill deck.
So yeah, I think that deck is underrated for what it's worth. I do think the deck is underrated, but like, John, where does this deck rank against that tier one category?
Well, it's Modern is always shifting. It's like, for example, if people start playing blue white, that is the worst matchup for Arclight Phoenix. I don't think my version has a chance. I think the Crackling Drake version has a chance, but it's still, you know, highly unfavored. But you know, there's decks that are good against blue white. Spirits is really popular. I think that deck's probably good against blue white. So you know, things can change quickly, and people be more prepared for Phoenix. Something like Timely Reinforcements is a really good card. There's things you can do. I don't think any deck in Modern can really stand out as like the best deck for a long time, because people will adjust, but people might adjust slowly. So right now, I think I would say Spirits. Then I would probably say Phoenix. I don't like ranking Tron too high because I think it has some vulnerabilities. I think KCI is probably my third choice, but you know, we have to be proficient with it. Not everyone can play that deck.
Caroline's really sad that you said the things that you just said, John. And
about Sean?
She let you stay at her house for free. So we're going to move on to Seth after you just daggered Caroline that hard.
Well, to be fair, okay, I have another point to make. I think that the tokens I want to make for myself are Wurmcrow Engine tokens.
Oh, man. So we get
am I back in the good books or what?
We get like a slimy John and like, yeah, a refreshed John.
A negative and a positive.
You certainly timed that announcement well, John.
She did let him stay there for free. With that being said, Seth, I agree with. I'm really glad that you and I both feel the way that we feel about John.
Tron is still like five or six. Like, it's still a great deck.
Yeah. Regardless of that. I hope our patrons appreciate the amount of work it takes to do a single sideboard guide, let alone a sideboard guide for 40 decks.
I decided I was gonna keep going until I couldn't. I didn't have enough yet. Like when I start looking on Goldfish and I don't know what's in the deck, I don't put it on the list. So I think Martyr Proc was the last one before it was like blue, black, red, no name. So
yeah, John, thank you for that, and I want to say thank you from all of our patrons in the Constructed Critics Facebook group at $12 or more. That means a lot, and you didn't have to do that, and it means a lot that you did. So thank you. Seth, you I literally posted a Facebook video or a video to Facebook of the U.S. soccer team of the time that we beat Ghana in the World Cup, which was our last win in the World Cup. And there were tears streaming down my eyes. And that is how I felt rooting for you going to this World Magic Cup. With that being said, what did you do to improve at Magic this week?
It may come as no surprise if you're familiar with the fact that I was playing the World Magic Cup, that it is related to that. I actually found myself, because I was kind of the team captain, I think you could probably call me the best player on the team, from an outside perspective. I've been playing Magic for a long time. And anyways, I was kind of the guy on the team that I was the role model, and I was kind of the director, the leader of the team, of the United States team for it doesn't even matter what it was for. Yes, it was for playing Magic, but like it could have been for playing soccer, right? Like, I mean, who's to say? But it was a really unique experience for me that I don't think I'll have back. It's normally, if you play a team event, you're playing with players who are your friends or who you've chosen to play with, right? And for this, you're playing with your fellow country people. And yeah, it was just really a special feeling. I felt like I was able to be a good role model for these guys, and I learned some things from them too. And I learned that there's a lot of things in team events, especially, that are just outside of your control. So if there's, you can try to focus on all three matches at once, but if you lose a match or your teammate loses a match, or if you're playing against a deck that is just straight up better than yours in the matchup, there's a lot of things that can go wrong. And I think this week I just kind of was able to enjoy my experience being at the World Magic Cup beyond any sort of result beyond the result. And so that's sometimes very hard for me to do. And I was able to do that even at such a big stage.
What were the three decks registered, for what it's worth?
I was playing Golgari. I had Justin playing Jeskai and Dylan playing Celestnia. We made a couple sacrifices in terms of the choices, and there was also this like metagaming thing of who sits where. Like, had I maybe been sitting in a different spot, then maybe I wouldn't have been playing as much against Jeskai, that type of thing.
Were you in the middle?
I was in the middle. I did feel like we were able to win a couple games because I was in the middle, because I was able to help us get out of the limited portion with a 2-1. So that was definitely pretty important.
So I want to say one thing about this, is that the World Magic Cup was one of my favorite tournaments, and to see it go is really sad. But I'm really proud that Seth is the forever captain of the United States team. And I also want to give a special shout out to Autumn, which probably the best the woman/non-binary player in the world, for being the forever English champion. And I hope that she appreciates that, or they appreciate that I for one recognize that and appreciated that going to this tournament, and I hope that they hold that title in their heart forever. So
it's a really special tournament, because if you like, when I went, I realized, wow, there's this many countries that care about Magic and that play Magic, and they played really, really good Magic, you know, and these are small countries, and I'm like, wow, like this is, I mean, it makes you real, like, you know that it's a global game, but when you go to the World Magic Cup, you're like,
yeah,
it puts it into a different perspective.
And to be honest, there was one of my goals, once my child had grown up, was to become a U.S. national champion. I've won my state multiple times. And, you know, one of my next goals was to be a U.S. national champion and to help represent the United States in that tournament. So to see it go away is really sad for me. I know that we have a Canadian captain and a U.S. captain here. But that was one of my goals once my son had grown up. So with that being said, we're going to add a new segment to this week's podcast. And that's going to be a pro's perspective. So, I'm going to add a grinder's perspective to the end of this one, but I'd like to limit this, if we can, to about 10 minutes. But, you know, what is happening in Magic for John and Seth and for the grinders? And then, you know, how does this impact us? So I want to talk about the Magic Pro League. And with that being said, we're just going to start with you, Seth. Sorry. What is the MPL and what is...
So... Yeah, I'm one of the members of this elite pro player group. So I'm getting a 75K salary, and it is split between – there's two parts to the salary, by the way, and that's a common misconception. Part of it has to do with streaming. So I'm going to be streaming on a regular basis, and that's something completely – well, almost completely new to me. I haven't been a streamer for most of my life. And the other part is to be playing in these Mythic Championships. And so the Mythic Championships is the new name for the Pro Tour, split between playing, and they're calling it tabletop, however you want to call it, paper Magic and digital Magic. So I see this as a big step. We're leaping into esports, right? And Magic, when you consider the longevity of the game, it has some might call it old school, right? Is that there haven't been these major changes to it. We've seen other games like Hearthstone kind of pop up as card games that have really making a big name for themselves playing online. And I think that this is going to really take Magic to the next level. We want the game to grow, and there's no reason why it can't be both a very, you know, a great paper game, but now that we have Arena, people love watching Arena. Like, we just had this Twitch Rivals tournament, which was really cool. I was watching it this past week. We're seeing Yeah, it was really impressive. There was commentators for it. I think there was 64 players, and like, we're seeing more legitimate like people streaming Magic for a living. Like, that wasn't something you could do, you know, a year or two ago. Even 2 years ago, I like don't really remember that as much. So we're seeing really a push towards playing online, and that's kind of why this esports idea became known. So as far as the pro community, right? We've had this community for so long, and it's been like 100, 200 players worth of silver, gold, platinums. We could all kind of call ourselves pro Magic players. And the issue was the issue with it is that Wizards couldn't accommodate for everyone, especially financially. And so no one was really truly happy with what they were getting. And so instead, what's kind of happened is the 32 players like myself are getting what we feel like we've been wanting for however long. And so I'm in a different situation than John, and I'd love to hear his perspective as well, because while I'm quite happy with the change, I think it's good for Magic. I can also understand the flip side of the coin, that there's other pros out there that are not in the MPL.
No, go ahead. I do want to ask Seth, like, do you remember when you found out about the MPL? Were you like, what was your immediate reaction?
Sure. That's a good question.
Like, I can't even imagine that happening. Like, you get an email saying, yeah, oh, here's 100K or whatever it is.
I actually got a personal call. Involved was the vice president of esports and a couple other like major faces at Wizards of the Coast. So I was like, wow, this is important. Like, they want to talk to me. Like, I always consider myself like a small fish in a very big pond. And so when I got the call that I was being offered this money that was going to make, it seemed like it was going to make my life better. And I mean, I was initially really stoked. And I still am. And I realized more of the details, but you know, the $10 million that they were putting into the tournaments, that was kind of the aspect where I was able to take away, well, yes, I am in an exclusive kind of club league in this case. But if they're also making the prize pools bigger, which has been the other thing that I've been kind of waiting for, all right, like the prize pools have been the same for however long, like when are they going to up that? And so when I heard that they were making those changes, it seemed more like a win-win for everyone rather than not just me. And so I was able to be a little bit selfish in the moment and be like, well, this is what I want. Like, I'm excited for this. And where this could be great for me. I mean, it could evolve beyond where it is. There's going to be a bunch of new tournaments. Like, I love playing Magic at a very high level. And before this year, it was just Pro Tours. And for me specifically, if I'm able to go to all of these Mythic Championships, if you consider them Pro Tours, then it's like maybe eight, like double the events at that level than I was playing in last year, right? So it's more opportunities to do well, to make money, and to grow the game. I'm a little bit nervous because there's a lot of changes. There's a lot of unknowns. We don't know who's going to be in the league next year. We don't know this. We don't know that. I think everyone in the community wants more information, right? We want to know what the PPTQs are going to look like, or this or that.
And I hope those don't exist, for what it's worth, Seth.
Sure. And there's a lot that's going on right now. And we know it's big change. And we know, like, we want all of the answers from Wizards immediately. That's everyone's reaction, including myself. But
yeah,
I'm in a pretty advantageous position, having already signed a big contract.
So I'd like to thank you for asking that question, John.
Yeah, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but
No, you're okay. I think that John and I are legitimately happy for you, Seth. And, you know, if we look at Magic in the last 3 years, I think Seth is the best Magic player in the world, and you deserve to be able to support your family I don't care if you're the best whatever. I don't care if you're the best volleyball player in the world. I don't care if you're the best, like, I don't care if you're the best, like, rock, paper, scissors player in the world. Like, there's a world in which if you're the best at something,
like, it's just always scissors, right? Isn't it always scissors?
Yeah. I don't know.
You have to think scissors, scissors, scissors till you win.
I think I fall into the category of a player where I don't think anyone could argue that I belong in this league, at least for this coming year. And
yeah.
And I think that there's definitely some community tension over, well, should this person have been in the league or the
pointing. I don't think you're one of those people. I think that you are legitimately one of the, if you're one of the top three players in the world right now, and John and I are happy for you. And I'd like to just kind of point out the pros and cons from the grinder perspective really quick. And then I'd like to move on to John, because I think John is in a very different world than I am. Number one, I'm really happy that PPTQs are gone. I think they're the worst thing to ever happen to Magic the Gathering, like, of all time, by a pretty substantial margin. As somebody who's qualified for the Pro Tour, who's lived through PTQs, who's lived through PPTQs, who's lived through top 16s qualifying with their Pro Tour at GPs, who's lived through top 8s, who's lived through different levels of Pro Tour or GP success qualifying for the Pro Tour from a grinder perspective, PPTQs are literally the worst thing to ever happen to Magic. And their death should literally be celebrated. They're horrible.
Tell us how you really feel.
Well, can I ask you another question, Spencer?
Yeah,
what do
of
you
course.
Think? What do you think about the idea of being able to qualify for one of these Mythic Championships just by playing Arena at home?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, as an MTG dad like Seth, that's actually good for me. This is actually a positive for me that I can lay in bed with my wife and watch a TV show as I play Magic the Gathering Arena and try and grind my way towards qualifying for the Pro Tour, which I could have never done before. And as a dad, I just could have never done. It's one of the positive. Arena is one of the best things ever in my life to happen in Magic the Gathering, both from a content creation perspective, because I get to play more Magic than I ever did since having my child. As many listeners know, I qualified for my first Pro Tour and had tons of issues in the form of multiple miscarriages and things like that, and Arena has just made it so that, you know, I can just do it in such a smaller time frame that I can be there for my wife, I can be there for my child, I can be there for the hard times in ways that I never could before. But at the same time, I do wonder the value of a Grand Prix, and I think John might disagree with me here, but I do wonder, like, what is the point of me paying $200 for a plane flight in which only 8 people qualify for the Pro Tour? Maybe I have to go early, play in a PDQ, then play in a GP. Then if I don't day 2, play in another PDQ. But as somebody who has seen the price of PDQs increase at GPs, I am not paying $80 for a PDQ in which only one person qualifies. I'm literally never going to do that.
Well, I just registered for a team PDQ for $300 at GP Vancouver. So $80 is nothing. I would say that, okay, so GPs are going to be different. There's no pro points after Seattle. But I still think, like, if your goal is to play on the Pro Tour, a GP can still be a great event. Like, they're going to be softer for one thing, because you won't have as many pros traveling them to get, you know, pro points for gold or whatever. And if you have, like, 2 buys, like, you have a pretty decent chance of qualifying, probably easier than winning an online PTQ.
Sure.
Or, and I think, like, also, I don't know, like, the way I feel about GPs, or the way I used to feel about GPs, I think, like, doing well in a big tournament like that is really feels like a special accomplishment. Like, I remember the first time I top 8ed a GP after not playing Magic for 5 or 6 years, I came back, played for 6 months and top 8ed a GP. And I thought I would never top 8 a GP. And I played on the PT for 3 years. And it was just like, you walk into a room with what was at that point like 2,000 people, and, you know, there's going to be one winner, and, like, just making top 8 of that tournament is just really fulfilling in its own right, regardless of invites or prize money. Or, and I think, like, I will still always want to play a GP that's, you know, local or that I can drive to easily. I don't think I'll be flying across country, but I'm already trying not to do that because, you know, it's a losing proposition anyway.
But hold on. Can I
go for it.
You and Seth are very different from me, right? Like, Seth, you had a Grand Prix win. You take a break. You win another Grand Prix. You're literal, if I'm not mistaken, you're literal next Grand Prix. And then, John, you have a Grand Prix top 8 in Toronto and then a win in Atlantic City within 1 month.
Hexproof. That'll do it.
but like, you know, as somebody who has cashed Grand Prix and has gotten pro points at Grand Prix, like, it is unreasonable for me to fly to Atlantic City from where I'm at to try and do this.
Well, was it reasonable now? Like, would you fly there now because you're getting points towards bronze or gold?
No, but was it reasonable then for you in 2012?
Can I compare it to the other big tournament circuit that's out there? Because I think for me, that's
for
the
SCGs?
Easiest.
For SCGs?
Yeah.
I literally won't fly to an SCG for what it's worth. I think it's actually not worth it.
Well, there's some people that do, right? And I feel like the Grand Prix, they still have this a lot of money. The competition, if you... Like, for me, yes, I'm not going to be going to as many Grand Prix because I've got the streaming going on. And there's no longer as much of this pro point attachment to it, but it's still going to be one of the main ways you can qualify to these mythic events. And if the competition is maybe not quite as high, because if you have players like me not going, then it opens the door for other players to occupy their spots in the top eight.
Sure.
And they're also rebranding the name. It's Magic Fest, so there's a lot of other things you can do on the weekend besides just the main event. There's also the fact that you can pick and choose what formats you want. Like, where else can you play a limited tournament where you are going to be able to play sealed deck and then draft and then draft and then draft and do all of that, you know? Or where can you play Legacy at this level or what have you?
That's a really, really good point, Seth. John, last night, you and I talked about you specifically. We talked about your ability to break into this top 32. And you told me, quote, "I have never tried to play for platinum in my life. I didn't see the point." You're in a different world now. No. Go ahead.
I think, so I want to like qualify that a little bit. The difference between gold and platinum for the most part over the past 5 years has been appearance fees.
Sure.
Basically. Gold and platinum both get invites and fights to every pro tour. And that's what I cared about. I cared about playing the PTs, trying to do well at the PTs. I would have certainly liked to try to qualify for Worlds. But if I missed on platinum, it felt like I'm losing a paycheck. It just didn't feel like it didn't matter as much to me. Like, the difference between silver and gold mattered a lot more to me than the difference between gold and platinum.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why I didn't try so hard to get there or didn't get there.
But how do you feel now? Like, you tomorrow, you see your co-host Seth, in this legitimately really good situation where, Seth is making good money playing Magic the Gathering. Magic the Gathering, John, is one of your loves. Where do you feel like you could end up, or where do you want to end up as a gold pro in this new world?
Well, there's so many unknowns that it's really hard. I haven't even really thought about how it affects me personally. I mean, I've thought about, gold's going to change. It might go away. It might change. But the top 32, like, I wasn't close this year. I don't know what place I was in, maybe 70, 80th. So it's not like I was like one of the few who like just missed and really has, a claim to be upset about, maybe the process wasn't fair, how they picked. People, for example, like Greg Orange, he won a pro tour. He's platinum, qualified for Worlds. Currently in the standings, I think he's 13th in the world. But because they're going off last year's standings, after he won the PT, he's like, well, I don't need pro points now. I'm not going to go to these extra GPs I was going to go to.
Sure.
So he ended up finishing like 38th or 39th. And now he's out of the MPL, and it's kind of like really brutal for someone in that spot or someone who finished in like 34th position and, was like, could have attended another GP if they knew that line was what was going to matter. But I'm not in that spot. I'm not in the spot where I was close. You asked me yesterday, like, whether I felt I had a chance to be in the top 32 at some point. And I think like, it's going to be based off results at Pro Tours or Mythic Championships. I feel like a lot of, like, these are not necessarily the best 32 players in the world. Like, Seth is going to be there either way.
And I think we agree there, right? Like, the Seths, the Owens, like, those people are going to make it. But, like, when I look at you, John, you have qualified, like, you are the equivalent of, like, the Craig Wescos of the world. Like, you literally have not missed a pro tour in years. Like
Craig Wesco has a few top eights. So I don't have any top eights.
All right, whatever. But yeah, like
Wesco was at the last Pro Tour.
Yeah, he was not. Yeah. He was not, for what it's worth. But like you're one or two wins away from that same. Like you started 10-0 at a Pro Tour. Like it's not like you are incapable of these finishes. And I think
I have it. Like if I play every PT this year, I have a chance. I mean,
yeah.
I don't think I'm a favorite to top 32, but like, if you look at my standings over the past 5 years, I mean, I think I was 16th in the world one year. And then there was only 14 platinums. Like I've been close. I mean, I have to have a good year. I don't think it's not a given, but like,
here's what Wizards of the Coast has announced.
Yeah.
Just to be clear, is that they've said they're going to keep their benefits for the pro levels through the year, right?
Yeah.
And so we don't know if there's going to be I don't know. Is there going to be anything after the top 32? Do you feel like it would be is it okay for Wizards to, even though there are a bunch of players, you know, who consider themselves pros, who had this playing Magic as their primary profession, do you feel like it's okay for those players to essentially, you know, in a way get fired? You could call it however you want. They'll still have their chance
so unfair, right? Like you can get cut from a football team, you can get cut from a basketball team, you can get cut from a soccer team. Like the idea that you deserve for some reason to be a professional Magic player compared to any other sport, like, is kind of insane.
I'd like to hear John's perspective on it, because he's kind of
sure.
Like I don't know if there's going to be a pro level below. Like, is there? It might just be MPL and then qualifying for Mythic Championships, and there might not be anything in between. Would that be something that you feel like Wizards has the authority? You know, would that be okay for the community? Do you think?
Well, okay. So first of all, like I know, like anytime this kind of topic comes up, there's always gonna be people who say their company, they're trying to make profit, they can do whatever they want, and there's no defense to that statement. That's obviously true. The question is whether they should do it. And I think so. The theory that they're going with, and the theory that I think a lot of people buy into, is that the players at the top are something special. They can build a brand around. They're going to attract viewers. They're going to market the game, and they're irreplaceable. Whereas, so that's the top 32, and how you get the exact top 32. Maybe I have some issues with how they did that, but whatever. They have 32 players. The other players, the 32 to 120, like say golds and above, for example, are pretty replaceable. It's they don't have a strong enough brand that like. Okay, I mean, if I don't play the next PT, it's not going to affect Wizards' bottom line, right? And there's a lot of people in that spot. And as long as those seats are filled with someone, they feel it's okay. I think that's a problem. And maybe I'm only viewing this from a competitive standpoint, but like, if I look at like FNM, right? And I see people spending hundreds of dollars on a standard deck. And I feel like they're doing that because they want to play this deck in a PPTQ and try to qualify. And the PPTQ players are playing, you know, tier one decks that they've bought or bought packs or whatever, because they want a chance to play in the RPTQ and the chance to play on the Pro Tour. And then the people who've been on the Pro Tour are trying to get there again and try to get enough points to be bronze or silver so that they can maybe become like, it's like the whole ladder of achievement to me has always been important. I've always been trying to do better than I've done before. And without that, my concern is that why would you ever spend $300 on a deck to pay $5 to win a promo? Like there has to be more to it than that. Now I could be completely wrong. I mean, the game is great. So like maybe people love playing standard and are going to buy these decks no matter what. I view that as somewhat problematic if there's no chain. Do I think it's unfair? I think there some of the way that Wizards did it, and I want to qualify this because when I was thinking 3 months or 6 months ago about what it would take to make Pro Magic viable, like I had a list in my head, and the first thing on the list was players need to be paid a living wage. The best, the elite of the game, whether it's Platinums, top 32, or whatever the definition is, they should be making salaries. In my head, I was thinking like 100,000. They should be paid good salaries. They're really smart people dedicating their lives to this game. And I felt that like goals were maybe around like the 30,000 mark. And this to me was such a far-fetched idea that I didn't even suggest it. I did not, like I was talking to Wizards people and I never brought it up. I was like, this is never gonna happen. I gotta focus on something that maybe actually has a chance. And this announcement, like they just made that a reality. And like, even though I don't agree with, you know, the fact that they arbitrarily made the cut last year and left some people at 33rd place or whatever on the outside looking in, or how Greg was screwed, like the fact that they made that commitment is so huge that, like, yes, I have issues with their bad communication. I have issues with, you know, the retroactive changes, the fact that they're, instead of it dropping down to the 34th place player when someone backed out, they went to 40th, and they're basically choosing the criteria to fit the outcome that they want. Like, okay, I have issues with all of that, but this is such an incredible step that they're taking. That has the potential, if the league works out, to be so good that I hope that they keep some sort of chain for competitive players to build on their achievements, whether it's like an amateur league. Like, I don't know what they do in like League of Legends. They have like the Academy leagues or whatever it is, the Challenger leagues. Like, I hope they do something. I hope that gold has an equivalent and silver has an equivalent and bronze in the new system. But yeah, I think that commitment is just huge. And they did, by the way, a lot of other things that I think are really good that maybe they might get some flack for that I think had to be done. I think they had to create a level playing field where foreign players can compete on the same, like getting rid of pro points at GPs. Like, I know that Spencer, that makes them feel worthless to you.
I mean, no, it's because I'm an American, right? Like, it's.
Yeah, I mean, like the problem, one of the big problems with the Platinum mentality is that Platinums were not the best players. They were the people who spiked the most recent tournament or the people who traveled the most, as well as the best players.
Can we actually quantify that? Because I have some numbers here to quantify what you're saying.
What part do you want to quantify?
Just the three of us. So I traveled to very little Grand Prix in the last year. What do you think? What do you think my ELO rating is in the percentage of Magic players in the world?
You mean on ELO project?
Yeah.
I mean ELO with the ELO is I really like ELO.
Yeah.
But it's implemented very poorly for Magic because the K values are too high.
So that's fine. I agree with you. But I mean,
yours could be anything. I don't know. You could be anywhere from like 1,700 to 2,000 based on your most recent results.
Yeah. So I had a. So for what it's worth, I did do my last Grand Prix. I'm in the top like 1% of Magic players. You are ranked 274th.
Okay.
On ELO Project, Seth is ranked 57th. And while the reason I want to wrap this up with this is that. Is that between the three of us, while Seth is literally one of the best Magic players in the world, while you have literally qualified for so many Pro Tours in a row, like something I could never dream of doing, John, that Wizards has given all of us hope that if we do the thing and we are good at Magic, and we have good results for a year in the tournaments that they tell us to, we can play Magic professionally. We're all in the top 1% of Magic players.
I just want to respond to
John. Sure.
I want to respond to what John said earlier, and I think that his take on this is really just excellent. Like, for me, I am someone you like. People don't want to hear necessarily what I have to say about this changes because I'm one of the 32. I'm one of the few that is clearly benefiting this. I'm going from Wizards of the Coast for the past, you know, however long I've been a pro, even though I've maybe been the person with the best results over the span that I've been a pro. I still haven't made a living wage from Wizards of the Coast. It's from sponsorships and from things of that nature. So this is very different for me.
That's my same point, right? Is that all of a sudden from the results, you know, from you being that good at Magic, you suddenly have a career that you did not like. It's easy to like TCG players probably been amazing to you, Seth. Like legitimately they've been amazing to you. But the TCG player is not responsible for your results. They're not responsible for the advertising that you bring to the game of Magic the Gathering outside of the fact that you wear a TCG player shirt at an event. And like the fact that tomorrow or whatever the tournament is that you're playing at, the PAX East, right? The fact that you're going to play in that event because you're invited to the event and you get a salary for showing up is not something that we had before. And I agree with John. I think that Greg Orange got screwed. And I think... Go ahead, John.
No, I mean, like, in... I just... We don't even... Like, there's just so many...
Unknowns, yeah.
We don't even know. Like, I don't even... I played in this... Like, I was gold last year. I don't even know if the final standings are based on the 12 cap or the 6 cap. I have no idea.
Sure.
And like that might have changed who the top 32 are. And what I would have liked to see, I mean, we all know that platinum is an important cut, right? I would have liked to see that if there's 37 platinums, that there's the bottom 10 have a play-in 1v1 to see who's in the league, or maybe the top 16 are locked and everyone else plays the tournament. I would have liked, like, I feel they don't have to do this because they're a for-profit company, but we work so hard and make so many sacrifices, and we didn't know we were competing for a top 32. And that, to me, it's really unfair. I wish they had thought about that and thought about who might get left out and taking that into account somehow. And I felt like everyone who was platinum should have had a shot at this. I don't know, the last Pro Tour apparently doesn't count for last year or next year. Good for me because I did badly, but I mean.
So, John. I want to wrap this up I don't know where this will sit in the podcast. I don't know if it'll be the end or the middle or wherever it sits, but. Can I just get your. Is this good for Magic, John?
I was starting to say the living wage was the huge thing. But they made a lot of other important decisions. Getting rid of airfares is going to make that was a big spew in terms of their expenses, because people would book, I don't know, people book whatever's airfare is convenient. They don't book the cheapest airfare. They have to pay a travel agency. Getting rid of nationals, the team series was a hugely stressful thing for pros to try to find rosters and try to make it work with their individual sponsorships. And just focusing everything on Pro Tours, paying out to last place. You should never qualify for a PT and have it cost you money. Like, you need to, I don't know, I think that's a big step.
Me money. I day two'd the Pro Tour, and I literally was negative like $400 on that weekend.
And even like losing the World Magic Cup, which is sad because it's an exciting event, like they needed to level the playing field and focus on their primary version of pro play. And I think that they made a lot of good decisions. And I think that the three ambassadors that they chose did a really good job of making sure that the system takes into account like what's going to be good for pro play going forward. I hope that they do something to account for the competitive ladder in some form. And I wish they had taken into account how a retroactive cut is really unfair to some players, and I they haven't announced everything, and I hope that they do something specifically for the platinums who are left out. To me, those are the people who should really feel screwed. And one thing, they kind of, like Seth was saying, like he's one of the 32, and obviously it's a really good thing for him, and it's true for the other 32 players, and they kind of sort of bought everyone's silence on it. And like, I feel really bad for the players who like want to speak out and say, hey, I really got screwed by this, when everybody is so positive about it. So that's kind of why I'm trying to bring up that aspect of it. And I hope that something is done to you know, compensate them or make them part of the system. That we'll see what happens.
Seth, is this good for Magic the Gathering?
I believe it is. Like, I like to think about this impartially. It's pretty hard to do that, but it's a great opportunity for Magic to grow. The prize pools have been stagnant for so long, and yes, it's easy as someone who has been a pro year over year and who's not in the 32 to look at this in a negative light, because some people are getting excluded, and that's tough. Wizards, I think, is acting their business, and they're trying to make the best decisions to grow their company and to grow Magic. And I'm lucky enough to be one of those people who they've decided to bring along for that ride. I'm hoping that the community can kind of come together here. I am worried, but I'm also excited because it's change, right? Like, there's so many, like, we haven't seen what a Mythic Championship played on Arena looks like. We haven't seen, like, what this Invitational is going to look like, or who's going to be invited to it, or what these streams are going to look like for the top 32. So I think that a lot of players, because they haven't actually seen these changes become enacted, in their minds, they have formulated, they thought about how it's going to be for them and how it's going to impact themselves without actually knowing if that's true or not. And so I think it's right now, it's the fear of the unknown. I'm hoping that right now, at least for the next year, it seems like a win-win for everyone for the most part, like, especially like American gold players who are still going to be qualified for the rest of the Mythics. Now you have double the prize pools, and that more than offsets the fact that you may be losing out on a couple of plane tickets. So it's going to be more big tournaments overall. And like, yes, I don't know what it's going to be like after this year or the next year. But I'm hoping that the community doesn't fracture in some way, and that we can like kind of get excited about this together. Are there people that got screwed? Even though I'm in the MPL, I'm willing to admit that there are people that, you know, got the raw end of it. And that's going to happen whenever you're selecting a group like this. It's going to happen. Like, do I think that bringing Li Shi Tian onto the top 32 was correct? I actually do, even though like it may not have been the quote unquote fairest decision. There's other things that are, you have to take into account, like regional.
He's going to stream in Chinese, which is going to be big, right?
Yeah. So like they wanted him. He just got elected into the Hall of Fame. They're not making the decisions, you know, to accommodate everyone.
They're not stupid.
That's just how it's going to be. But I think they've got good people. Like, I've talked with some of the new esports team, and they know what they're doing. Like, they are efficient. There could be more sponsorship deals, and so I'm excited for it. I'm hoping that this thing really does take off, and that the players who most of the players are kind of wondering how this is going to go, and it should be excited. Like, I'm hoping that players can kind of like take to heart that yes, there are going to be, the MPL is getting, it is possible now to make a living, a legitimate living, a good living playing Magic.
Yeah.
And just by playing, like, forget the content stuff, forget everything else. And that was something that you could not say ever. So even though it's a smaller number of people than we would like, Wizards of the Coast has a bottom line.
Yeah.
Money wise, right? They can't just make a league like this with 100 players, right? So these things, they're going to take some adjustments, and I, like I said, I'm hoping we can stay positive together as a community, so far we've been able to do that. And
yeah, we can say France. You just always have to buy dinner. That's all.
Well,
I'd like to wrap this up in the form of, first of all, I've said this to you on Twitter, Seth, but I'm extremely happy for you. You deserve it. I meant it when I said what I said on Twitter. And John, I think that you are the literal nicest guy on the Pro Tour. You know, over the past 2 weeks, I've gotten to know you really well, and or more so than I thought I knew you, and you've exceeded my expectations of you. And you know, I will be rooting for you more than ever in these Magic Mythic Championships. But so we are pretty far into this episode. We're gonna skip the deck of the week, and we're gonna go right on to our training ground. So every week on the show, we want to talk about something that's gonna make you better at Magic or life in general. This one is very Magic focused. It's the most Magic focused that we could get, and we're going back to the roots of constructive criticism. I want to talk this week about, you know, one of the biggest things that we see in Magic, and that's managing your resources. This is a long time. Segment of constructive criticism. We've done this. We've been featured on the Mothership multiple times for this specific type of episode. The first time that we ever did this was episode 7. And I think this is episode 261, for what it's worth. So we've been doing this since before, you know, John Finkel came on the show for the first time. But one of the things that this episode is built on, and these type of segments are built on, is that there are misconceptions in Magic on the type of things that you have control over. And one of the number one things that you can do in Magic is controlling the things that you have control over. And focusing on those things. So this week is going to be an overall review. And that doesn't mean that if you don't love certain segments of the show, that you can't message me or John or Seth and say, I really love this part. Can you go deeper on this? Because this is a big episode, Seth. Like, this is the whole game of Magic. We're talking about managing your resources.
Oof! Wow, we're going deep then, huh?
Yeah. So this is probably the biggest level up episode since these guys joined. And I'd like to kind of start with what are resources in Magic. So the resources that I have listed, and then we'll go to you first, John, is life totals, mana advantage, card advantage, and simulated card advantage. But one of the things that Michael and I really pushed on this show in the last, like, 2 years, John, was mulliganing. So before we get into these resources, I would like you, John, to talk a little bit about mulliganing and understanding that resource in Magic.
Okay. Do you want specifically for constructed? Because I feel like the mulligan theory is very different. Okay. The big difference, just to touch on it, is that constructed decks function a lot more consistently than limited decks. Limited decks tend to have, like, you know, sometimes you don't have a perfect draw, but you're still in the game. So in limited, the pure number of cards you see is much more important than in constructed, where what you do in the first 2 to 4 turns is going to really almost determine the game in a lot of cases. So you need to mulligan a lot more aggressively in constructed. Now, I have a few things to say about mulligans. First, the first kind of thing I would say is similar to how I view like a color preference in draft, for example. Like, if you want to take the best red common over the best green common, but the green one's a little better, but you think red's a better color, I feel like that decision is really difficult, but in the end, they're both fine picks. So with mulligans, there can be some really close decisions where it's like 53% in your favor to mulligan and 47% if you keep, where you're really not gaining or losing that much on the decision. So I don't, it is an important thing, but I think, like, what you need to do is avoid some of the pitfalls of just seeing lands and spells and just keeping when your hand isn't really functional or your chance of winning the game. Like if you're playing Tron in Modern, for example, and you have, you know, three lands, but only one of them's a Tron land and you don't have any ways to find Tron lands, like you're just almost never going to win that game. Every constructed deck is going to be able to do something powerful by turn three or four, and you're just going to be playing land, 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 and, you know, Oblivion Stone. Like it's not enough. So yeah, I think constructed, you need to mulligan fairly aggressively to make sure your deck can function. But I don't feel that agonizing over the really close ones is as important as people make out. So yeah, that's my opinion.
Seth, do you want to add anything to that before you move on to the other resources we talked about?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's no like mathematical formula that's out there to be like, yes, you have to mulligan. It is technically math, but like it's so far beyond what we can actually comprehend that like I am someone that personally like mulligans a little bit less frequently than I think a lot of other players do, because I just value the extra card. Like what John's saying is definitely true, and I also think that there are certain decks that want to mulligan more. Like if you're looking for very specific cards, and Tron was a good example of that, where you basically need to assemble the Tron by turn three or four to win. So like that's what you're looking at your hand to be able to do. Whereas there's certain a lot of mid-range decks, like if I'm playing Jeskai Control in Modern, if I have like four lands, three spells, it almost doesn't matter what they are. I'm probably keeping the hand. Like so it's somewhat deck dependent as well, and it's also knowing like what your deck needs and what is still in it. Like if you're playing Control and you have a bunch of lands in your hand to open, that's a lot better I think than having too few lands, because you know you have card advantage in your deck. Like you know you have some card advantage and removal, and it's somewhat matchup dependent. Like if you know you're playing against an aggressive deck, then maybe you need a cheap removal spell in your opening hand more, that type of thing. So there's a lot of variables with mulliganing. There's also, like, I've been playing for Magic so long that I'm well before the Scry rule, and in many ways I probably should have adjusted more to the Scry rule, because it does up your percentage points based on it makes mulliganing a little bit better than it had previously. So
it's like one of the most. I like to call it the Vancouver Mulligan, for what it's worth, as I participated in the first Pro Tour that I had this
role. That is what they officially called it, actually. It just didn't really stick.
Yeah, it was called the Vancouver Mulligan Rule.
Yeah, this is fun fact, side story about mulliganing. We were at the face-to-face or the Channel Fireball thing. I was standing behind John Stern, and he was going through his deck, and he looks over, and I'm standing behind him, and I said to John, I said, "Oh, I wasn't looking. I'm really sorry." John had literally gone through all of his cards in his entire deck while I was standing behind him talking to KYT, and I felt like super embarrassed that I was standing behind him as he did this. Do you remember this, John?
Remind me where it was. This was Vancouver, you said.
Yeah, you were playing blue red. Artifacts, and I was standing behind you as you shuffled through your deck looking for certain things.
I don't remember. I don't know. Was I upset? I don't think I would be upset.
You were not upset, but I felt super bad.
Okay.
But it was the first tournament that they had this mulligan rule, and also John's team took advantage of that mulligan rule as they destroyed people with turn two scissors.
Oh, that PT. Yeah. You know what I think? The Scry Mulligan, if you take a lot, not every deck, but a lot of decks in Constructed, especially Modern, that a Mulligan and a Scry, like six cards in a Scry, is
so
almost
good.
As good as it's almost as good as seven.
I completely agree. This is actually what I thought going into this Pro Tour, for what it's worth, John. Is this is, I no, Seth is saying no.
Well, I hadn't finished my thought. Like I was, my thought was it's almost as good as seven, but the risk of going to five is why you can't just mulligan all the time. Like going to five is a significant disadvantage. So that's kind of where I'm at. Like, you're basically taking a chance of almost just losing the game outright when you go to six. But I think
here's what people should not do, which happens all the time. It's the most frequent thing I hear after a match is, I should have mulliganed that hand, and then I lost. It's like, all right, you lost the game, but like the mulligan didn't work out. That doesn't necessarily mean that you should have mulliganed the hand. You drew poorly after the mulligan. Like, I kept a hand with like Llanowar Elves, Wild Growth Walker, and then like a bunch of land with Golgari. Yeah. Like, I wasn't sure if that was the mulligan. Maybe it was, but like, you're in the moment, you're making the decision whether you should mulligan or not. If you keep the hand and then you lose, that doesn't mean that you should have mulliganed. And I think
I agree with that. One of the things that, you know, I really focused on that PD is like, how does this mulligan rule affect limited? And I had a really good record in limited at that Pro Tour because of that.
Well, I still think you want to try to avoid mulliganing in limited with the Scry, but...
I drafted aggressive decks, though.
Yeah, I mean, you have to sometimes.
Yeah. But one of the things that
turns out there was one Grand Prix where I made the finals and I did not mulligan. Believe that.
In the whole Grand Prix?
There was zero mulligans involved.
We did the math on this on one episode of Constructive Criticism. We like pulled a bunch of pros. We like sent them Twitter DMs and stuff for like their last two Grand Prix and if they could remember them. And it was something like 30% of hands are mulliganed across Gold Pro and above. So the fact that you said you top eighted a Grand Prix where you didn't mulligan is like a complete anomaly.
I think the proper percentage is probably in the 25% range.
That's pretty close to 30, though. Like that's pretty high. So, all right, we cover mulligans. I wanted to get that out of the way. Before we talk about other resources, I want to talk about life totals next. And there are three things that I have in this category: control/midrange decks, Odonto Vanguard specifically, and then aggro mirrors. So, as somebody who has built their entire Magic career off of control and midrange decks and ramp decks, I want to kind of touch this first. And I actually didn't qualify for a Pro Tour specifically because I got too greedy on this specific thing. I was at above 20 and I didn't take 7 and I cast a Settle the Wreckage that cost me the game at a team RPTQ that would qualify to three of us for a Pro Tour. Seth shaking his head.
Was it from a Carnage Tyrant, perhaps?
No, it was not. It was against Mono Red, and then they won the game through... Fight with Fire, actually. But, you know, one of the things that I really learned from this event is that it's really easy to be disciplined in Swiss rounds. To say, like, this 3 damage is not worth a card because I'm going to recoup these cards because of these cards in my hands later. But it's really hard to have that same discipline when you're facing the thing you want in an event. And as somebody who played a lot of... green red Wolf Run, which was like a green red control deck, this was true a lot in that deck where you weren't exactly sure how to manage your life total to make sure that once you cast your Titan or once you cast another thing in your deck, that once you untapped that your opponent was either dead or they were dead in 2 turns and you needed to manage your life total correctly. And I think that combo control is a really good way of teaching this metric. But with that being said, from my side, John, you know, when you're playing, I know that you yourself have said you're not comfortable playing control decks, but you are comfortable with playing things like Green Black Snake and decks like that. How do you like to think about your life total as a resource when you're playing those mid-range decks?
Well, I think I play control decks too. I'm just not comfortable playing like a control mirror and a time limit, but and I've played them at like PTs and stuff too. The question you're asking me is, how does life total operate in a mid-range matchup?
Yeah. So like, or not even just in a mid-range to mid-range, but like when you're playing something like a green black snake deck or something like green black Golgari, like how do you manage that resource specifically in the form of life totals?
Well, I think whatever matchup you're playing, and it happens in a lot of mirrors, whether it's control and control, mid-range, or aggro, one of the most important things you have to be able to do is understand when the natural way you play your deck is the wrong way to play your deck. So for an aggro mirror, it's going to be like, okay, when am I not trying to do as much damage as possible? When am I, you know, leaving my haste creature back to block, stuff like that. And I think the mantra, use your life total as a resource. I mean, we understand why that's a mantra, because, you know, things basically that don't affect the board are generally like, basically in a mid-range matchup, you want things that affect the board, right? You want have more board presence. And in a control matchup, like you just want to make sure you get as much value from your spells as possible, where it doesn't matter if you win the game at one life, you're still winning the game. But what you have to be able to recognize when you have to shift gears, in a mid-range matchup, the natural tendency would be to play sort of for the war of attrition, like make sure you're getting value, 2-for-1s, make sure like you're saving your removal for their best creature, that kind of thing. Whereas, and so that might mean like, you know, not killing their 3/3, taking some damage, using your life as a resource, but you have to be able to recognize when you can be put under a, you know, pressure where they're getting value only because you're at low life total. And you might just lose the game outright. So yeah, just knowing when to change roles is probably the most important skill in a mirror match, I would say.
Seth, when you're playing a control deck, you don't ever have the option of switching roles, right? You have the option of like, other than starting to attack with like your 7/7 or your 5/5, you know, where do you see using your life total as a resource as that control deck?
I mean, it may be land sequencing, like if you're playing modern and you have a bunch of, or standard, if you have a bunch of shock lands in your deck, for instance, and just like, well, should I like take 2 from my steam vent so that I can hold up this counterspell, or should I? I mean, it's situational. It's gonna also, like, if I'm playing against a very aggressive deck, like if I'm playing against burn, for instance, or a deck with a bunch of burn spells, I'm likely to just want to take as, like, to preserve my life total by any means necessary. But most of the time, if my opponent doesn't have that reach to deal me the last few points, like say a card like Banefire, for instance, is like, well, if your opponent has Banefire in their deck, then that means that they can just like deal you 8 damage or whatever out of the, like, later in the game. So you actually have to try to stay at a high life total if you can for the entirety of the game, or else you can just lose that one card. So like, if I'm playing a matchup, like, for instance, if I'm playing standard against Golgari, I don't really care how low my life total goes as long as it's not 0, because, like, I'm just focused on having more cards. If I have more cards than my opponent that do something, I'm probably going to end up winning the game. And I think that if I'm not playing against aggro in general, I'm just mostly concerned about having more cards and more resources in that perspective. And I'll use my life total as a way to like let my opponent think that they're winning the game. Like if they're getting in for 5 damage, but I'm killing one of their creatures, normally that's like very much what I want to be doing.
Yeah, you just touched on the exact reason I wanted to talk about Vedanta Vanguard in this. So for those who don't know, we have 2 patrons who have been playing a ton of my green-white mid-range deck that was based upon Seth's deck from the Pro Tour, as well as a 10th place deck from the GP right before the Pro Tour. And I kind of merged the two decks and kind of took the best of the two things and kind of put it out there. And, you know, we have one person that won a PPTQ, and then one person that I think top 4-3 PPTQs in a row with the deck. And one of the things that, you know, was pretty talked about between those two players is understanding how to use a Down to Vanguard. Instead, you just said that you would pay 5 life points to get rid of a card, and the number of times that like people have said like, "Oh, I don't like a Down to Vanguard card. Like it just trades for like this 1/3." I'm like, I don't know how it has ever traded for a 1/3. Like,
yeah. If you're a Down to Vanguard dies, then you pretty much lost the game. That's how I look at it.
Yeah. So this is a thing that I don't know if it was in the Constructed Critics group or in the Constructed Criticism family group. But one of the things is like, when do you activate your Down to Vanguard? And I literally said, when I'm not dead.
Like every turn.
Yeah.
Every turn. No. Go.
Yeah. So John, why is that?
Well, if you're the aggressor and you're talking about playing aggro against a mid-range or a control deck, I mean, this is a very difficult to kill threat. You're going to try to kill them before they can stabilize. So anything you can do that kills them, regardless of what it does to your own life total, is generally going to be good. That's basically just the answer. That you want to preserve that guy at all costs.
Yeah, so if I get to kill your Jade Light Ranger that's a 3/2, I'm going to do that. Like, that gets a blocker out of the way for the next turn that my Adonto Vanguard swings.
What I won't do, and this is a bit of a dig here, but I won't.
The Ken Yuka Hero? I didn't watch that match.
I won't block a Secret Squire and then activate it. I won't be doing that.
No, but I think that one of the things that we kind of learned from Adonto Vanguard is like the value of a card. And like this value that you know, life points are life points, but cards on board, cards in hand, like they're worth a lot of life points, and we don't realize that until we get into those situations. So we gotta talk about the next thing that I love the most in Magic of all, Seth, and that's my favorite card of all time, Seth, of all time, is number 1 Lotus Cobra, number 2 Sarkhan Unbroken. So I think you know what I like, and that's being ahead of my opponent on mana.
You like playing those cards together?
I mean, I've never done that. That sounds like the dream. Had they been in the same format, I did qualify with one of those. I did qualify for the Pro Tour with one of those two cards, but unfortunately, you know, I had to use Rattleclaw Mystic instead of Lotus Cobra.
I played Lotus Cobra in a modern GP.
In
Jund, actually.
I have a Lotus. So you've actually been top 8 in Grand Prix for longer than Seth. Did either of you ever top 8 a Grand Prix with Lotus Cobra in Standard?
Wait a second. That may not be a fact. But...
Well, hold on. But Seth had like a 5-year break between two P top 8s, right?
Seth wanted. Didn't you win a GP in like 2008 or something like
2007,
that?
2007, yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
So. Yeah, but like, I don't. You didn't like do anything after that for like a long time, right?
I mean, I did. I finished
2000.
This is hold on. This year going down the wrong path.
I am, because Seth literally won a Grand Prix in 2007 in Limited, and then won a Grand Prix. His literal next Grand Prix finish was also first.
Hey man, if you want to try to break me down by knocking my accomplishments, that's probably not gonna work.
That's not what was happening. I just said you were the best Magic player in the world. Let's be clear about what happened.
I know.
With that being said, like I love those type of cards. And Seth, from what I've seen of your record of playing Druid of the Cowl, you also love that type of advantage. So what is it about the mana advantage that's so helpful to you when you think about resource management?
Well, I see being ahead on mana as a temporary thing. Like if you get that jump, it's not actually, you have to have something, some way to convert that extra mana. But if you're able to have card advantage cards or very high impact cards and you're able to play them ahead of the curve, then that can end up meaning that those, like being ahead or a turn or two on mana can mean like 3 or 4 extra cards. Like, for instance, if you play Karn or Vivian Reed in Standard a turn earlier, then you're activating your Planeswalker, and just one activation of those cards is an extra card. So, like, you've already gained back whatever, like, your druid of the Cowl or your line of elf, that's not really how you're winning the game, but it can be a way of facilitating getting going quicker. And in formats where it's less about answers and more about threats, then that makes the ramp even more important.
Yeah. So I unfortunately, my wife was pregnant during the time, but I actually built the deck that qualified previous co-host Casey Bloodworth for a Pro Tour in the form of a green red ramp deck. And you know, one of the things that we kind of talked about going into that is the value of those 2-mana ramp spells. You know, John, you've been playing Magic for a long time. Like, you obviously know the power of ramp and growth in Farseek, right?
I mean, I like playing Birds of Paradise and Llanowar Elves, but yeah, those are fine.
Well, we have two segments here. One of them is ramp spells. One of them is mana creatures. But I don't think that the world disagrees with you in this, right? Like, I played green red devotion at the Pro Tour with lots of mana creatures rather than the mana ramp spells, and I think that one of the things that people don't understand is that if I play a Llanowar Elves, I have so many options, right? I can play Goblin Rabble Master, I can play, you know, a Gift of Paradise. Like, there are so many things that going from 1 to 3 offers me, or going from 2 to 4 offers me, that I don't get out of those control decks that are trying to, like, interact with you on turn 2, counter you on turn 3, and do different things on the curve. And if I get ahead of your curve, I gain an advantage against you.
Yeah, I mean, I think the mana advantage, well, you want to talk about spells? Like, I think the mana advantage you get when you're playing, like, an aggro or mid-range deck against a control deck, there's, in every sort of matchup, there's going to be, like, some things that really matter. And one of the things that really matters against a control deck is getting a good threat underneath their counter spells or forcing them to tap out so you can resolve something very impactful. And, you know, mana acceleration is going to really be a key part of that process. And in a mid-range matchup, it's going to be like sticking, you know, your 5-mana planeswalker while they're playing their, you know, their Ravenous Chupacabra or whatever. Like, you're just doing something that's much more powerful than what they can do. And then everything you do from the rest of that point on is them trying to catch up or not being able to. Most games are kind of more or less decided in the first 6 or 7 turns. That's obviously not every game. There's some where you can, you know, top deck a few good cards and get back into it or get a bit lucky, whatever. But like, if your first 6 or 7 turns matter a lot, then sacrificing turn 2 to have a really good turn 4 or turn 1 to have a really good turn 3 and 5, that's a really good thing to do. So definitely important.
We also, like, we've talked a lot about the positives about the mana ramp, but we also have to talk about, like, the flip side to it, right? Because you can't just put a bunch of a mana ramp cards in your deck. You can be a ramp deck, but, like, the ramp cards themselves traditionally are not the actual ways you're winning the game.
Outside of Primeval Titan,
sure, but that's not really a ramp. I don't even see that as a ramp spell at all. That's just a card that gets you lands. But like,
well, it means that's the payoff for the ramp, right?
Yeah, that's a 6-mana. It's a 6-mana spell. I don't really consider 6-mana spells to be ramp. Like,
so
yes, Gilded Lotus technically it's ramp, but like, sure. Like for me, I came from the Wood Elves, Kadama's Reach, like Explosive Vegetation. Those were like my top end ramp spells that I would play.
Sure.
But yeah, anyways, playing too much, like playing Golgari, for instance, if I'm adding a bunch of Llanowar Elves and Druid of the Cowls to my deck, am I cutting lands or am I just hoping that those creatures don't die? So there's, and then if I'm drawing them late game, like, could they have been something else that would have won me the game? Like, those are all questions that you want to be asking yourselves.
You know, it's funny. I'm super biased in all of this. Ramp is my favorite strategy by like a substantial margin. You know, I think that if we look through history, you know, we look at Farseek, we look at Explosive Vegetation, and we see some of the best standard decks in history. And, you know, to me, the number one thing that gets lost on a lot of players is when they're playing a ramp deck, they're like, this deck is bad. It's like, Well, you sequenced your spells wrong, and they aren't countered because you're dumb. And it's funny because people are like, oh, this deck's super easy to play. And to me, as somebody who's enjoyed these decks through history, it's, well, the hardest part about it is understanding what could my opponent be representing and what can I do this turn, whether it's playing a Llanowar or Elves, whether it's playing a Druid of the Cow, whether it's playing a Farseeker and Explosive Vegetation, is like, what is my deck trying to do and how can I maximize that advantage this turn? And doing that each turn to try and gain the advantage that your deck is built to have. Does that make sense, John?
It does. I think like when a pure ramp strategy that uses a lot of those ramp spells, when that deck is good, there's a specific reason, and that there's something really powerful that you can do with a lot of mana that your average mid-range deck just cannot deal.
Yeah, I agree.
It doesn't matter if your deck is like 35 cards that do nothing but produce mana. If you're resolving whatever Primeval Titan and just winning the game, or
a Dragon Lord of Tarka. I completely agree. This is exactly what I've told people, and this is kind of a similar strategy. If you look at something like the Aetherworks Marvel deck, it was just a ramp deck that it was ramping into energy, right? Like it wasn't a combo deck. It wasn't a control deck. It was just it was ramping into, I'm going to mulligan to try and get this card, and I'm going to make as much of this effect as possible. And understanding the advantages that you can get in resource management was really important in that, and I think that mana advantage played an important role in that specifically. But I'd like to talk about card advantage for a second, Seth, and I would like to ask you a question before we get into this. How many times have you registered Divination or Read the Bones or similar effects in a tournament?
Well, I mean, I can't answer that for you.
How many times have you won Worlds with one of those cards?
Well, I think Owen had more copies of Read the Bones than I did, but let's not get into that. Because I had four copies of Abzan Charm in my deck. All right,
that's the same card.
I had Courser of Krufix. I had like a bunch of stuff that could get me card advantage. I mean, card advantage is something that you basically cannot play a mid range or control deck and say, and you don't have card advantage. You need card advantage to play any type of deck like that, pretty much.
So what is the difference, Seth, between this raw card advantage of like and the simulated card advantage of something you might see in like some of the, maybe is it Drake's decks in Standard right now?
I mean, yeah, they have bringing an Arclight Phoenix back from the graveyard. That's card advantage because you're not actually casting it. You're getting a creature into play from the graveyard without having to. So it's basically, it's not costing you a card to put the Arclight Phoenix onto the battlefield. So that's, but by doing that, you're netting a card. Sure. So that's it. Like every time I get a prize amalgam back from my graveyard playing Dredge, I'm actually like netting cards.
Up a card.
You can look at card advantage in different ways. There's the traditional way of drawing two or three cards. Maybe it's casting Explosive Vegetation where you put two lands into play, so you're up an additional resource. So it could be a Planeswalker. Planeswalkers are great card advantage resources because you play one, you activate it, and then if it doesn't immediately die on an opposing attack, then even if your opponent uses a removal spell on it, generally you're up a card. So we see a lot of ways to get card advantage. Explore is a great way of potentially getting it right now in Standard. And aggressive decks tend to not be relying on card advantage because card advantage generally comes later in the game. So if you're an aggressive deck, you're not really you're not playing for a late game. So a lot of times there's not that much card advantage, or if you're playing card advantage, it's like a super card advantage spell. Like we think of Experimental Frenzy, like that's like potentially like 20 cards, you know? So it's like a super high impact card. So we'll see those decks built a little bit differently. And I think that a lot of players get confused and they just think about like a divination or a harmonize or like whatever as being, all right, I want to draw another card, so I'll play divination, but or Sphinx's Revelation or whatever. But drawing cards is not the only way to accumulate card advantage.
I think that like if you just look at standard, the cards that tend to be the best in standard are the cards that are sort of naturally provide you with some card advantage. I'm thinking about something like Rekindling Phoenix, which, you know, on its face takes two removal spells to kill. If they ever have to, you know, lightning strike it and then kill the token, that you're getting like a great amount of card advantage right there. Or History of Benalia, which they're like on curve powerful cards that need very specific answers if you're not going to get card advantage off of them. So you don't have to work very hard to get them.
Yep. I agree with that.
So I think we've done a really good job of covering, first of all, Seth, thank you for kind of covering like the difference between like a divination effect and other things, and like kind of how people don't realize the fact that raw cards is a valuable effect. I mean, John, you kind of covered that in Mulligan, and you talked about Unlimited, how, you know, you value those cards pretty highly. And before we move on, you know, Seth, when I was talking about those Is it Drake decks, I was talking about the ability to maybe draw a land card. And to be fair, this is actually true in Jeskai Control right now, where you can discard that land card to something like, you know, a Chart the Course or a Tormenting Voice, and then turn that into a different card later in the game, you know, with something like those two cards or a the current 4-mana draw 2 with Flashback. You know, I think that people don't realize the power of those effects. So
yeah, I consider that to be more card filtering, because you're not actually netting a card, but with the Tormenting Voice type effect, or like a Jumpstart card is like a very similar type thing, like a Radical Idea, for instance. It's not I don't consider it actual card advantage, but card filtering is also very valuable because lands, as you're saying, can be almost useless later in the game.
Yeah, John, one of the things that I think about when I think about simulated card advantage is, you know, when I'm playing something like a Planeswalker that makes 1/1s, the ability to turn those 1/1s into cards throughout the game, right? So like if I'm making a 1/1 with Karn John, and then, you know, I block a 2/1 or something along those lines, like what did that Karn net me in that 1/1? Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, I mean, Planeswalkers, like I was talking about Rekindling Phoenix as like built-in card advantage, and Planeswalkers almost by their definition are that, because you get basically a card's worth of effect every single turn it's in play, which forces your opponent to now play a different kind of game. First of all, a lot of decks don't have a lot of good answers for a Planeswalker, so they have to build their deck differently because they can't just allow this card advantage to continue. Or they have to stop attacking you so they're not putting your life total under pressure if they're an aggro deck, and take time out to kill a Planeswalker, or just try to kill you while you're generating this advantage, this constant advantage. But yeah, I mean, almost every single Planeswalker has card advantage built into it in some form.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Seth, when we talked about your green-white deck, we talked about the ability of a Johnny, for example, to bring back those 2-drops. And that ability is so much more powerful than his other abilities, just because of the raw cards it brings back. But what do those 1/1 counters bring into effect as far as like what is a 1/1 token or a 1/1 counter worth?
I mean, those are tougher to quantify because it's not actually a card that you're generating, but certainly it's very valuable over the course of multiple turns.
My 1-year-old has walked into the room. Hi, Maxwell. Yeah, is that John?
Unfortunately, I can't see your screen, but that's okay.
Is that John? Okay. All right. You gonna go back to mommy? You don't want to go back to mommy? Oh, go get to mommy. No, that's Daddy's couch. Go to Mommy. I am. All right, bye-bye, Maxwell. Sorry, guys.
No worries.
It's all right.
Where were we?
Yeah, I remember where we were.
Oh, so, yeah, the Planeswalker turnover turn.
Yeah. Yeah, you just asked me a question. I was going to answer it. So
go ahead.
I remember. So, yeah, a card like Ajani is, it's kind of hard to quantify, like, because if you're giving yourself, like, getting a creature back is clearly, all right, I'm getting a card. Whereas if you're pumping up your team with plus one counters, or if maybe you're making tokens, as you mentioned, those aren't like actual cards, but they're definitely resources, right? They're like, is one card worth two tokens or two plus one, like that's it. You can't really think about it like that. But it's some advantage that you're getting that a regular card, like there's a card that puts a plus one counter on your creature or a card that makes 2/1/1 tokens. Right. So
can I ask how you manage that though? So, like, it's like a PBD grinder, Seth. Like, I need to know, do I bring back my Adanta Vanguard, or do I put 2/1/1 counters on? Like, how do I make that decision?
Well, I mean, I'm always trying to protect my Planeswalker so that it lives the next turn.
That's a good answer.
And it can always eat a removal spell, so, like, it also is going to depend what my board is. Like, if I feel like giving those counters to creatures so that I'm going to be able to make a good attack, or so that they're going to be out of range of Deafening Clarion or whatever it may be, that's going to factor into my decision.
John, when you think about, you know, so as somebody who's played like a lot of Standard recently, like the number one thing I find myself doing is protecting my Vivian Reed, for example. Because when you get to that Vivian Reed to 8, there's not a matchup in the world you lose.
Okay.
So, you know, how do you protect that simulated card advantage? Like, maybe it's raw card advantage. Maybe it actually ends up being raw card advantage, right? Like, maybe that chart of course turns into just draw 2 cards. Or maybe, you know, whatever. But when I look at something like a Discovery, or when I look at something like... you know, in Modern, you played a lot of, you know, the Scry effects. Like, how do you make the decisions to, is this worth a card? So for me, today, I played a lot of blue-red, and I bought them double cards, and I felt like I drew 3 cards in those Discovery turns. Is that similar to how you felt in your Scry effects in Modern?
I think, like, you can't, if they're not directly comparable, like a scry to a draw effect. I mean,
sure.
I don't know. I mean, pretty clearly that in your typical game of Magic, draw one is better than scry one. I mean, I think it's closer when you go draw one versus scry two, but draw one's probably still better usually. But I mean, obviously in a deck like Arclight Phoenix, where, you know, you basically just want to find your Phoenixes and thing in the ices that every time you, like, Serum Visions turn one, like, is getting you 3 cards closer to the card you need. So it's, you know, it's definitely a powerful effect. So I think decks that are trying to find specific pieces care a lot more about Scry than like your typical deck. I don't think it's like a direct comparison, but
sure.
I mean, if you think,
and it
if you
can
think
be
Frost
right,
Scour,
like I think that what Seth said is true, right? Like, if I have 2 tokens and those tokens trade for 2 straight up cards, that's a 2-for-1. But if those tokens just gave me incremental advantage throughout the game, that's there's not a direct comparison for those. And I think that Scry effects and things of that nature are the same.
Well, you can, like, so taking the Arc like Phoenix deck, you can sort of theorize, like, on your turn 1 Serum Visions, like, how often is the Scry gonna turn into card advantage? Like, basically, let's say you're finding a thing in the ice. A thing in the ice is gonna, if you get it on turn 2, is more likely to flip and do 7 points. 7 points and have a 7/8 and reset their board. That's worth several cards, right? If you can find an Arclight Phoenix that you have an outlet for to discard, like a Faithless Looting, that's going to be a free spell at some point. So Arclight Phoenix is a pretty good job of turning those early scries into card advantage or virtual card advantage. Whereas like a Mulligan Scry in Limited, for example, it's not card advantage. It's just basically going to help your curve a little bit most of the time, or help you maybe find your bomb a little more often. But it won't really be card advantage necessarily. So I guess, yeah, in a modern deck like Arclight Phoenix, it's getting pretty close to draw, but it's, you know, still a different effect.
All right. I would like to wrap off the virtual card advantage with something that's not in the show notes. And I might have the most experience, but I don't think that's true. I want to talk about Brainstorm really quick. Because, you know, we've talked about, you know, life totals. We talked about mana advantage. We talked about raw card advantage. We talked about simulated card advantage. Seth, how many Brainstorms do you think you've cast that you felt like you just cast Ancestral Recall?
Zero.
Oh, man. You have not cast enough Brainstorms. you know, this is one that comes up a lot for our Legacy players who are listening, but you know, I think that one of the biggest lessons for me in this managing your resources game was my win percentage with Cobblade and Cobblade Standard. You know, I had won literally thousands of dollars playing Cobblade. And I was in a tournament locally where my opponent cast a Squadron Hawk, Brainstorm, puts two Squadron Hawks back and cast a Squadron Hawk. And I thought, oh my gosh, I've given up hundreds of dollars in value to not understanding how to use Brainstorm correctly. And before we wrapped up this resources game, I wanted to just mention like the fact that Magic is hard. John, games of Magic are hard. We're going to make mistakes, and there's so much we can learn. And even when we're playing the best deck in Standard or the best deck in Modern, this managing your resources game is so important.
Are you referring to brainstorming with Jason the Cobblade?
Well, I also have had this experience with Brainstorm and Preordain, or Brainstorm and Ponder, or Brainstorm and you know, Fetchlands.
Yeah, I mean, I think with Fetchlands in particular, those types of effects are definitely, the value definitely goes up significantly, for sure.
But
because you're able to reset your deck.
Yeah, but I think specifically with the example that I was setting was, you know, I think that in hindsight, it's 2020, right? Like, obviously, you just put your Squadron Hawks back. But, you know, I was a top 100 ELO rated player not doing that. And I was managing my resources wrong for hundreds of games with Cobblade.
You know what I think about Brainstorm, the card or the effect?
Sure.
I think about it the way I would think about chess, for example, where you can if you're I'm not like an expert chess player, I've played in like elementary school, whatever, but in chess you find a move that's good, and a lot of people just make that move, and then the really good players find a good move, then think for 5 minutes if there's a better move. And I feel like that's sort of how I view Brainstorm. Is like, no matter what you do with Brainstorm, it feels good. Like, Brainstorm is a great card. But every time I'm about to cast Brainstorm in Legacy or use Jace or whatever, I'm like, this is really good, but can I do something better? Because sometimes all you want to do is wait and have more options later. It's just, it never feels like casting Brainstorm is a mistake, but it's often not necessarily the best time to do it or the best way to do it. So I'd always think about that twice.
It's really funny. The last episode that we did before you guys joined the show, this was a point that Matt made on the podcast, was if you think it's time to cast Brainstorm, it's probably not time. You're probably doing it too soon. And then I think about the times that Seth has been on the show talking about Druid of the Cowl and like his experience in the last couple of tournaments, and I think about the advantage that Seth has gained from understanding that, like, the raw card advantage of Karn is worth more than other people are giving credit for. Karn is now a staple in MTG Arena. If you play against Golgari on MTG Arena, you're probably playing against a deck that's based upon Seth's deck. And I think that if we look at this episode through what we've gone through, it's a lot to process.
I thought you said Arena was all Vigilant Bailouts.
No, I... John watched me play free-to-play today, or listened to me play free-to-play today. But I think that, you know, if we look at Magic, it is understanding the advantages that you can gain in your resource game, because Magic is a game of resource management and executing upon those. You know, Seth might not play 2 Druid of the Cal tomorrow. He might play something different. But the fact that he played Druid of the Cal when he did was for a specific reason, right, Seth?
Yeah, I mean, it was, as you were saying, to accelerate into my Planeswalkers. I was doing it before it was cool. Apparently now most do have...
No, they cut the Druids. They're just playing your cards, man. Like, they're...
Well, the thing is, like, Druid of the Cowl, it also fills the same role as Seeker Squire in a lot of matchups where you have a 1-3 blocker. So, you know, it's you're getting the extra utility, I would say.
And it's also good with finality because you can make a 3-5. I for what it's worth, I'm on 1 Druid of the Cal now. I think Brad Nelson is also so. It's a good card, you don't want to have too many of them. Like in my first list of Golgari, I had 4, which was too many. But now I've scaled back a little bit, but I do think that they are pretty good.
But I think that the important thing is that when you think about Magic as a resource management game, you have a reason for the things that you're doing. You know, whether it's, you know, Seth with his Druid of the Cowls, whether it's John understanding, like, why he wants, you know, Thought Scour. You know, we have these great players on the show telling you why they're making these decisions, and they're doing it for this main reason of resource management, so... you can go to patreon.com/ccmg to become a patron of the show. You can go to, you can find me at Spencer13H. You can find Seth at Seth Manfield. You can find John at John Stern NTL. You can find the show at CCMTG. You can join the Facebook group on the Constructivism family. If you're a patron of $12 or more per month, that's $3 per episode. You get access to 40. 39.5, Cyborg Guide decklist for Blue Red Phoenix. You can go patreon.com/CMDG. You can become one of our constructed critics. You can join the conversation on the Discord. And then, you know, honestly, you can just message us or text us, you know, whatever. Like, I'm really responsive, and I make sure that these guys hear those messages, so let us know. You know, I'm adding a segment. We're getting rid of the "What did you learn?" and it's what I learned from these two. And you know what I learned from these two this week is that Magic is so hard, and that the idea of resource management is so hard. But when you think about mulligans, when you think about life totals, when you think about mana advantage or card advantage or simulate card advantage, you know, Seth talked about how he tries to protect his planeswalkers. John just did an entire tournament where his card advantage came from flipping an 0-4 into returning 3 cards to his opponent's hand. Like, Magic is tough. There's so many things you can do. And, like, your job as a Magic player is to learn how to best do those things. So, thank you everybody so much for listening. I'll see you guys next week. Magic.